And what I'm presenting today is a work in progress. This isn't a finished piece. In fact, it's perhaps hoped by some that this may go into my PhD dissertation. So we'll see. And so for that reason, I would welcome any feedback or comments on what I'm about to present. The title is The Untouchable Christ, Purity in the Gospel of Mark. Perhaps that title seems a bit provocative, The Untouchable Christ, but when we look at what Jesus does in the backdrop of the purity laws and their observance at the time of Second Temple Judaism, we see that perhaps from our 21st century perspective, we miss a lot that's going on level two. For those of you guys who've read What Does This Mean? What's going on level two that the original audience of Mark would see right away when Jesus does these things and when these things happen. So this is kind of my working thesis, working synopsis. The theme of uncleanness in Mark's gospel should be understood in part against the backdrop of the purity laws of Leviticus and the Torah, and how these purity laws were understood and observed during the era of Second Temple Judaism. Certain narratives in Mark, which would include the cleansing of the leper in Mark 1, the saving of the woman with the hemorrhage of blood, and the raising to life of Jairus' daughter in Mark 5, Jesus' defense of his disciples when accused by the scribes of Jerusalem of eating with unclean hands in Mark 7, and then the deliverance of the Syrophoenician woman's daughter from unclean spirits in Mark 7, that these narratives and what Mark is doing with these narratives may be more fully understood when read in light of the issues surrounding purity observance in the Second Temple era. In several of his miracles, Jesus touches or is touched by that which is unclean. According to the purity laws, Jesus is thus rendered unclean with these actions. And you might say that the original readers and hearers of Mark's gospel, and then the ideal readers and hearers of Mark's gospel, would be aware of this each time it happens in the narrative. At the same time, in these actions, Jesus overcomes uncleanness. Later in his teaching, Jesus will finally redefine what it means to be clean and unclean, and this will happen over and against the purity observances of the scribes. And we also know that the scribes here are also representing the Pharisees and what they taught. In the narrative of Mark, this teaching of Jesus over and against the observances of the scribes from Jerusalem not only justifies the eating of all food, Mark 7:19b, but it also sets up the first deliverance of a non-Jew who has faith in Jesus. Thus, in the narrative of Mark, this pivotal teaching of Jesus in Mark chapter 7 opens the kingdom of God to outsiders and foreigners. How a reader will react to Jesus' violation of the purity laws will ultimately depend on whether they respond to these actions with faith or unbelief. In other words, it could be that a good observant Jew observing the purity laws and how they were observed at the time of Second Temple Judaism would hear of these things and actually respond that Jesus, the Christ, was untouchable because he seemed to pay no attention to purity observances. And of course, this is the whole issue in chapter 7. This is what the scribes are going at Jesus for, is that his disciples are paying no attention to their purity observances, and then it's against that that Jesus teaches on what it means to be clean and unclean. But when Jesus touches a leper, when he's touched by the woman with the issue of blood and commends her rather than condemns her, and then when he touches a dead body, and there's no talk of Jesus purifying himself after he does these things, a pious observant Jew hearing of this could say this man is unclean. He's untouchable. He has no concern for our law and what it's about. On the other hand, when you hear that the leper's cleansed and the woman is healed and the dead girl's raised to life, that might promote a different response when you hear about these things. And so a level two reading, I would argue, would take into account the purity laws and especially the Second Temple purity observances that lie in the backdrop of Mark's narrative, the assumption being that the original readers of the gospel would be aware of these things, and so they would know that when Jesus touches a leper, something is going on. When he's touched by the woman with the issue of blood, when he grabs the hand of a dead girl, that there's more going on than simply him touching things, that in this, Jesus is becoming ritually, cultically unclean. And then the question, of course, is he? So my untouchable Christ has a question mark, the untouchable Christ. Okay, now the concern for cleanliness, of course, is rooted in the book of Leviticus and Numbers and other teachings throughout the Torah. Jacob Neusner writes in The Idea of Purity in Ancient Judaism that purity and impurity tameh or tahara are not hygienic categories and do not refer to observable cleanliness or dirtiness. This is a key distinction to keep in mind. They refer to the status in respect to contact with a source of impurity and the completion of acts of purification from that impurity. And so you become unclean if you touch something, a person or an object, that is unclean. You become clean by undergoing a rite of purification. And so he writes, if you touch a reptile, you may not be dirty, but you are unclean. Nevertheless, if you undergo a ritual immersion, you may not be free of dirt, but you are clean. And so these categories are not, as our mothers explained to us, washing us for church. It's not that we're unfit to go to church because we have dirty ears. If we touched a lizard, that would make us unfit, even if we washed our hands afterwards. We'd be unclean for the rest of the day, unable to go to the temple and carry out any cultic duties. Okay, and this was a special concern in the era of Second Temple Judaism. So Hannah Harrington writes in the Purity Texts, quote, the Second Temple period of ancient Judaism was marked by a heightened concern for purity. Issues of cult and purity engaged and divided Jews more in this period than at any time in antiquity. Purity was not limited to a handful of extremists who lived in the desert. That's a reference to the Essenes and the Qumran community, but was rooted at the heart of Jewish life. Although arguments continued over the degree of purity required, there was a general agreement among Jews that purification was necessary not just for priestly figures, but also for the laity. And so there's a heightened concern for purity at the time of the Second Temple Judaism, at the time when Jesus was carrying out his ministry. And then Neusner also writes regarding this time, the post-biblical history of the concept of purity and impurity is divided by the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Before that time, the practical application of the purity laws in the cult preserved their immediacy and social relevance. Afterward, the law remained significant, since menstrual and food rules bore important consequences for everyday life, but going to the temple no longer was important among the reasons for keeping the laws. And so very key for the Second Temple was that the temple actually stood, and therefore there was a cultic significance to being pure, clean, or unclean, impure. In other words, this affected whether you could go to the temple to worship. And then part of what the Pharisees were about at this time, and therefore the scribes from Jerusalem probably representing that interest, is that they, in a more rigorous way, tried to apply these rules to their own lives, taking up the dictum that they would be as pure as the priests were required to be pure. And so the ritually washing of the hands before table fellowship, this was what the priests were supposed to do in the context of the cultic worship of the temple. The Pharisees took this out of that context, and this was now their everyday life, observing this ritual washing of the hands. And so then table fellowship became a very key place in which the distinction between clean and unclean would be carried out. And so in addition to the text from Mark that I cited, you might add when Jesus is having dinner with Matthew and the sinners later in Mark chapter 2, that implicitly any reader would see this would suddenly not just be a matter of sinner and righteous, but also clean and unclean at the context of table fellowship. And now, as evidence to conduct this research, to look into the purity laws of the Second Temple era, people turned to the Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, Dead Sea Scrolls, Philo. There's a Jewish work in which he spends a lot of time reading Paul, especially Romans 14, the Gospels, Josephus, and then rabbinic traditions of the Pharisees in an effort to try to establish that these go back to before 70 A.D., and there's a lot written after 70 A.D., but this study is trying to focus pre-70 A.D. Now, it's interesting that when you look through the Pseudepigrapha and the apocryphal writings, the emphasis is more on moral impurity than this cultic ritual impurity. And so there's a concern for idolatry in 1st, 2nd, and 4 Maccabees, the Psalms of Solomon, the Assumption of Moses, the Letter of Jeremiah. In other words, idolatry would be the ultimate source of impurity and uncleanness. There's a concern for sexual sin in Tobit, Judith, Testament of the 12 Prophets, and then more general morals in the Wisdom of Solomon and other writings. And this moral impurity would include things such as idolatry, sexual sin, blasphemy, and lies. And it's interesting then that unclean spirits, a spirit would be unclean because that spirit represents either idolatry or lying. And so then, you know, Mark's gospel, he tends to identify demons as unclean spirits. And if you see the pseudepigraph and the apocryphal writings as a backdrop, what makes them unclean? It could be that they represent idolatry or lying. I don't know if that's what Mark is doing, but it's there in the backdrop. And interesting about this identification of moral impurity is the key thing, is that therefore when Jesus teaches on what makes a man unclean in Mark 7, he's not the first guy saying this, all right? There have been other Jewish writings that have identified uncleanness with moral imperfection before Jesus, and so Jesus is not alone. The only problem is, of course, what Jesus does is a little more revolutionary. He's saying this over and against the actual cultic practices of the scribes. Ben Sira, in his writing, stresses corpse impurity as one of the most potent forms of uncleanness at this time. This, of course, becomes key when Jesus takes hold of a dead girl's hand in Mark chapter 5. Josephus, in his writing, focusing especially on Palestine, he really provides a cultic setting for the rules of purity. And he talks about things such as funerals. Attending a funeral would make you unclean because of the death, childbirth, sex, food, and foreigners. And he tends to rank in priority these three issues when it comes to uncleanness. And you might even think of the layout of the Second Temple with the court of the Gentiles, the court of the women, and then the court of men, is that the first major barrier for uncleanness would be foreigners, Gentiles, non-Jews. They would rank as sort of the first level of uncleanness. And then after them would come women who suffer from gonorrhea or are going through the menstrual cycle. And then there was some discussion among some of the authors whether that woman in Mark 5 is suffering from a menstrual problem or whether it's a sexually transmitted disease that she has. And Mark doesn't tell us that because they don't really know, but could it have been a sexually transmitted disease that she's suffering from for 12 years? Well, I don't want to bear false witness against that lady, but that's been thrown out. But also at the second level would be leprosy, no matter who it affects. And so you think that the court of the Gentiles, foreigners are unclean, the court of women in their menstrual period are undergoing or suffering from a sexually transmitted disease are unclean, and lepers. And then the inner court would be men who are not purified. In other words, men who have become unclean and have not gone through the trouble of having themselves ceremonially purified through the ritual washing of water, sprinkling of water. Which means that if Jesus becomes unclean, but the Gospels, and here Mark, never really talk about any concern on his part to get purified from that, he would still be unfit to go into that inner realm of the temple. Now, could it be that the Gospels just assume that we think he's going to be purified because he's a good, pious Jew? Or are they not telling us that this happened because, well, it didn't happen? And then the Essenes, their view that the temple, their argument that the temple was invalid, really stemmed again from arguing that it was impure, in part because the Zadok line was no longer there. And interesting, Jacob Neusner, Jewish writer, he sees a Christian parallel with the Qumran community, that Christians also, he says, sort of see the temple as no longer valid anymore at the same time, although I don't know if we would say it's because of purity issues so much, but he says the Christians kind of share the Qumran attitude. Then the Pharisees very rigorously wanted to keep the purity laws outside of the temple, while many ordinary Jews thought that these laws only had to do with cultic worship and that mainly they were for the priests or for when we're in Jerusalem worshiping, but don't so much apply when we leave. The Pharisees, in their rigor to live pious lives, their dictum was that they would conduct their normal life at home, eating their ordinary food at their table, as if they were a temple priest, under their idea that basically we are a nation of priests, the holy nation, every one of us is a priest, and this is how then we will live that priesthood, and that we will, as the priest, must ritually wash before eating in the temple, so we will conduct ourselves at home. And in this, then, table fellowship becomes very key. We can't have table fellowship with a Gentile. We can't have table fellowship with a sinner or anything that is impure. And then the purity texts that come out of Qumran stress a number of these things. Corpse impurity, as you might say, the most potent cause of impurity. Very interesting, though, that corpse impurity was also a theme in the Greco-Roman world, even outside of the Jewish context. But a Jewish male or any Jew that became impure by touching a corpse or an object touched by a corpse or even coming into the home of a corpse. You can see how they're kind of more rigorously pushing beyond even numbers here. They become unclean, and it takes 7 days to purify. And a priest, it takes 2 weeks, 15 days to purify. And also, this could then be attached to graves as well. You don't want to be around graves. They could also render you unclean. So suddenly, the text about the Gerasene demoniac might come into the matrix here as well, since he's hanging out in the tombs. And notice that all in chapter 5, after he gets across the lake, you have this kind of unclean cycle of things going on. Okay, leprosy was a second tier. The issue, again, the issue is not the physical contagious nature of the disease, but the spiritually contagious nature or the impurity that's passed on to others. I remember something Horace Hummel stressed in Old Testament Isagogics is that we shouldn't read Leviticus as if it's about, you know, health and hygiene, you know, that God is being good and keeping us from eating pork because of trichinosis. And what he said was, there was no cure for trichinosis in 33 AD when Jesus declared all foods clean either. So it can't be about trichinosis, it's about something else. And so the Jewish writers stress this isn't about physical contagion, it's about the spiritual impurity that is passed on. That's really the issue. And interesting, they say the lepers were considered impure, even among the impure, and that anyone who sat or slept in a leper's house was unclean. And so very interesting, Mark 14, the dinner at Bethany, where is Jesus at? In the home of Simon the leper. Okay, so then you begin to wonder, what is this all about? Well, everybody will say Simon was healed. Okay, fine. Bodily discharges, Zob for the men, Zabah for the women, Leviticus 15. If a woman with an issue of blood touches something, it becomes impure. If she touches somebody, that person becomes impure. And this impurity is rated 3 days beyond the normal menstrual period. So if it continues beyond that, let's say 12 years, it's a big deal. And then finally, outsiders, Gentiles, are kind of a fourth tier of unclean. The Book of Jubilees speaks about this quite a bit. And the impurity is rooted in their idolatry. But finally, the mere physical contact with a Gentile makes one impure. So now when we look at the actual text of Mark, there's the story of the leper in Mark 1, 40, 45. And notice that in this text, the operating word is not therapuo, but katharizo. This is what the leper wants. This is what Jesus does. And so that's the word to make clean, to cleanse, to purify. And so you might say that this leper is not just worried about his disease, but the cultic implications of his disease. Now, there is a text critical issue. We have Jim Veltz here, but I don't think Jeff Klo has come back, has he? This is in verse 41. The participle splog. Nitzthes, there is an alternate reading, or gisthes. In other words, Jesus is either filled with compassion when this man comes to him, or he's hawking mad. France, in his commentary, I guess practicing a more thoroughgoing eclecticism, opts for the variant reading and argues that Jesus is hawked. Dr. Veltz, what's your decision at this point? It's the other way, okay, because it's D, and, you know, so you're going the more reasoned eclectic, or... Oh, you think it's a harder... Okay. Okay. And that makes sense, because even if you don't go with the variant, Jesus' behavior, when it's all said and done, is very strange. When he scolds the guy, speaks harshly to him, and ekbalo, casts him away. This is what Jesus does to the leper after. But it's interesting. Franz argues that the reason Jesus is angry is because the leper doubts that he's willing to heal him. And I would say that Franz's reading has kind of a picture of Jesus outside the text that's driving it. I would say that if Jesus is hawked, it's better understood in light of if we go with a variant, and my mind's not made up on this, if we go with a variant that Jesus is hawked, perhaps more because this leper has done what he's not supposed to do. He's broken ranks. He's come to Jesus, endangering Jesus and those with him of being ritually impure. And this is just the kind of thing that's going to get Jesus into trouble. And maybe Jesus doesn't want to get into trouble this early in his ministry. But even if you don't go with a variant, there's the problem that after Jesus heals the guy, he speaks harshly to him, embris ma'omai, and he casts him away. And then in 144, he asks this man to keep the outward observance. But the leper disobeys and causes problems for Jesus. And so even without that variant that Franz reads, that Jesus was not sympath- not full of compassion, but hawking mad. Even without that variant, we get the bizarre behavior of Jesus scolding this guy and casting him away. And why would he do that? And Franz really can't explain that part because this is already after Jesus has healed the guy. My point would be that the logic of what is going on in this narrative is best understood in light of the purity issues. The leper endangers Jesus and others with impurity. Then the faith issues, for the leper actually demonstrates powerful faith in approaching Jesus in the first place. So this leper, his problem is not faith, but that he's sort of done that which he shouldn't do. And maybe that's why Jesus speaks harshly to him and casts him away, or maybe this is just Jesus being weird. I don't know. But it's interesting. What this narrative does in Mark, this is for the first time we see why there might be, from an observant Jew's perspective, a legitimate opposition to Jesus in this narrative. Word of what Jesus has done has gone out. In other words, this leper disobeys, he goes and spreads it all over the place. But not all who are drawn to Jesus are sympathetic, as the very next narrative shows. Jesus forgives the paralytic, and there are scribes present who attack him. So not everybody who comes to Jesus because of what this leper has said is sympathetic to his cause. And perhaps we can see a root in this because it's actually Jesus has touched this leper with his hand. And so this narrative, I believe, and Dr. Veltz, you can confirm or deny this, it in a way kind of bridges the narrative of the long Sabbath day in the first part of Mark with the opposition narratives that come in chapters 2 and 3. In a way that this narrative kind of explains why, for the first time, why there might be opposition. But then notice how in the opposition narratives, Jesus doesn't duck the opposition once it arises. He, in a sense, only throws fuel on the flames. And notice, though, Jesus has touched a leper in this narrative, whether he's mad at the guy before or just bizarrely mad at him afterwards. In touching a leper, Jesus has rendered himself ritually unclean in accordance with the Levitical law and how those laws were observed at the time of the Second Temple. And anybody hearing this, any scribe or Pharisee hearing this, is going to be struck by the fact that he touched a leper. Now, of course, Mark is telling us not only did he touch the leper, but he katharizo cleansed the leper, okay? And so now you're stuck with the issue of, well, what am I going to make with a guy who breaks Levitical law, nevertheless cleanses a leper? Okay, the next narrative then where this becomes key, or should I keep going, or I started a little late. The unclean woman and the dead girl of Mark 5. This is an example of an intercalation in Mark where two stories are sandwiched together in order to interpret one another. Two possible issues of this intercalation might be faith. We get this from the level one signifiers in the text. But also, I would argue that another issue here is the issue of cleanliness. Now, unclean and unclean are not used in this narrative cycle, but they both could be implied first from the woman's flow of blood, her hemorrhage. That would be discharge impurity, and the girl being dead, corpse impurity. That the woman is unclean could arguably provide the best explanation in the narrative for, one, why she approaches Jesus secretly and not openly to touch his garment, and two, why she's afraid when he calls her out. This would be another example of kind of bizarre behavior on Jesus' part, but he asks, who touches me? And they say, you see the whole crowd pressing you, and he asks, who touched me? But he continues to look around, and the woman comes with fear and trembling, and she falls down before him and confesses what she did, and then Jesus commends her for her faith. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be whole from your disease. I would say that it's really in light of impurity that her behavior is best explained. First, her secretive touching of Jesus, and then her fear when he actually calls her out. She should not perhaps expect a commendation, but condemnation, for she, in touching Jesus, has made him ritually unclean. However, he commends her faith, and then he goes on with Jairus. And so when he gets to Jairus' house, what does he do? But he takes hold of the hand of the dead girl, thus rendering himself unclean for 7 days with corpse impurity, but he makes her alive. And never does Mark talk about Jesus trying to purify himself of both his discharge impurity from being touched by the woman or his corpse impurity from touching the hand of Jairus' daughter. Justin Rossow, are you here? Okay, he has suggested a structural interpretation of this text that would make the woman the mediator, who mediates the binary opposition between Jesus and the dead girl. Jesus is alive and clean when the story begins. The girl is dead and unclean. She's alive and unclean. And so by touching Jesus, she has now rendered Jesus able to go and touch the girl. Now, maybe Justin's reading a lot into that, but it is very interesting how that plays out. But that this does kind of show how this intercalation is not only about faith, but also about impurity, the impurity lying behind both the woman's condition and the girl's condition. And in a sense, the woman is cleansed and healed, the girl is made alive, but Jesus is left unclean for 15 days when all is said and done. And so then, the final narrative, I'll be quick here, Mark 7. The issue in Mark 7 is the observance of the Pharisees and that the scribes of Jerusalem are talking about. The scribes attack Jesus' disciples for eating unclean food, that is, not eating with ritually pure hands. And this is the role of the Pharisees, their effort to live as priests within their own homes, lived out especially with the table fellowship, their ritual washing, and only eating with the desirables. Jesus' disciples do not follow that same strict piety, probably because Jesus must not be teaching them that strict piety. Jesus points out the hypocrisy of his opponents and then redefines what makes a man unclean. And in this, he's speaking very much as the pseudepigraphal and apocryphal writings would, so he's not the first. But now he's saying this over and against the Levitical laws and how they're observed at the time of Second Temple Judaism. And so that's why Mark adds in 7:19b, I think those translations that don't put this in red letters are right. I think this is the narrator screaming out, cleansing all food. You know, Jesus redefines what makes a man unclean. What you eat goes into the stomach, out into the latrine. Thus, Jesus has cleansed all food. And then it's immediately following this narrative that we have the first non-Jew in Mark's gospel, the Gentile, the Greek Syrophoenician woman in Tyre, coming to Jesus with faith. And that story ends when Jesus casts out of her daughter an unclean spirit. And at this point in the narrative, the kingdom is open to non-Jews who do not follow kosher or any other purity observances. What do we make of an unclean Christ, an untouchable Christ? Well, faith in Jesus becomes key. You believe he's the Son of God and thus recognize his authority. In the end, even over the purity code, or you're stuck as seeing him as an untouchable, someone to whom you would never come and believe.